Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm just so excited to be here. I'm in this dream place.
This one comes highly recommended.
Dream place? What are you doing?
Get out of the car.
Yeah. The girl is still missing.
What's wrong?
I don't know who I am.
I wonder where you were going.
Mulholland Drive.
Come on, it'll be just like in the movies. We'll pretend to be someone else.
Silencio.
Hey there, and welcome to Rewatchability. We are an Entertainment One podcast on their network. My name is Blaine Waters. With me, as always, is...
Robert LaRonde.
And...
J.M. McNabb.
And this week, we are going to talk about David Lynch's Mulholland Drive. But before we get to that, I want to thank our Patreons. Those are people that go to patreon.com/rewatchability and give us $1, $3, $5 a month just to keep the podcast on a steady course instead of crashing and then us losing our memories and walking down hills.
It's happened to Rob a few times over the course of the podcast. I'm not going to lie. It's been 10 years.
Rob enters these fugue states. We bring him back. It's fine.
Happens to everyone.
So thank you so much to the people that have gone there and done that. They are receiving some bonus content. Sometimes they get an extra episode on something that no one else gets just for them. And most times they get the podcast free and other little perks. So if you want to support us, go there, check that out, patreon.com/rewatchability, and you can support us that way. And Jam, you wanted to say something too, right?
Yeah, I have something I want to plug too. It's my sort of last chance to do this. I am doing a marathon this coming Saturday, if you're listening to this when it first comes out, which is May 29th. I am doing a marathon for charity. Like, Blaine, you've done it through a few marathons, right?
I didn't listen to last week's episode. Are you actually doing a marathon?
I'm actually doing a marathon. It is a movie watching marathon.
Oh, okay.
But I'm doing the marathon.
There we go.
And it is a movie. You know, I've always wanted to do like...
You're going to carbo load?
I've always wanted to do like a charity marathon, but I'm not a runner. That's not a thing I do, but... There is this great event happening. It's through the Fox Theater, which is an independent cinema here in Toronto. Obviously, they've been shut for
great theater
most of the past year. They're on hard times, I'm sure. And so to support that theater and Cystic Fibrosis Canada, they're going to split the proceeds. They have organized this movie watching marathon. So if you want to sponsor or pledge money for me to sit there and watch movies all day, I'm going to watch at least 4, maybe 5 on Saturday. You can go to shop.foxtheater.ca and donate money. Put my name in the special instructions field so they'll know it's for me. I'm the hypothetical runner, the metaphorical runner. I will be running through cinema history for charity.
You should watch all running movies.
Yeah, Forrest Gump.
Yeah,
Run, Fat Boy, Run.
Blade Runner.
Chariots of Fire.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to do that.
Those ones aren't
Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner.
That's
one I assume.
All
I never saw
have Runner in the title.
Anyways, check that out. It's all great going to a good cause. And yeah, thank you to all of those who have donated already.
Wait, what movies are you watching? Do you get to pick them, or do they pick them for you?
Yeah, I can pick them. I think they have like some suggestions, but I think the idea is just to waste a whole Saturday watching movies. And
are you gonna like tweet or something?
Yeah, I'll be tweeting my as I try to endure this physical feat. I will be tweeting along. If you go to @JMMcNabb again on Twitter, that's my handle, so you can follow me there, and maybe I'll force you, Rob, to share it on Rewatchability. Share my progress.
Sure,
make sure I don't, you know, hit a wall. You know, I need your encouragement.
Yeah. Don't overexert yourself, Jim. Remember, you have kids.
Yeah, yeah. Keep a steady pace. Use some gels if you need to.
Yeah.
Powder up.
I want one of you to...
And don't be afraid to pee yourself, you know? You can't go to the bathroom. So just, like, let it go.
Yeah, man.
Rob,
you got this.
If you only knew. Yeah. We don't have to talk about this anymore.
I'm so interested. Do you know what movies you're going to watch?
No, I'll plan it. I'll figure it out.
Okay.
Yeah, you should
tease some out or something.
Yeah, I feel like you could do all just stock up on all the rewatchable movies that we're going to be doing in the next months. And just get it all out in one day. Like do
yeah,
double
get
duty.
All your work done.
Yeah, do double
yeah,
duty.
Yeah, that seems like too much work. To figure that out in advance. We do this so like last minute. Also, you know, I do want to say before we get into the show, R.I.P. Charles Grodin.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
We are recording this shortly after it was announced that he passed. Had, you know, we not already decided to do Mulholland Drive, like, you know, we probably would have done Beethoven or Clifford this week or one of the...
Oh, we got to do Clifford.
Yeah, for sure. We'll still do those. But, man, he's great. And especially, you know, when you go back and look at his earlier comedies, like when we grew up, we just thought he was the angry dad who hated dogs.
Right.
Yeah. But when you go back and watch his work in the 70s and 80s, he is just a comic genius. And
The Heartbreak Kid? So good.
So good.
The Angry Dad is where all comedians go later in life. Like, all comedians go to that. Like, Kevin Hart is just doing a movie where that's his... he's playing
but
a dad.
But he does it the best. I mean, he's the personification of Angry Dad. You know,
I remember I rented The Heartbreak Kid like 10 or 15 years ago. And I remember my wife and I going to the video store and asking at Queen Video. And they were like, they had to look it up on the computer. They're like, it says we have it on VHS. Do you want that? And we're like, sure, because it's not on DVD. So they had to like, we had to wait for like 15 minutes while they like went into a basement vault to dig out this.
They just blow the dust off onto you? Like, yeah. Oh, thanks. Thanks for that.
Those nerds thought they knew cinema. They didn't know shit.
That's right. Would you take a DVD of Clifford instead?
Okay.
I would.
Well, let's get into the podcast. We're doing Mulholland Drive, David Lynch film.
Okay, wait. Now my name's Philip LaGarue. Okay. Let's continue.
Okay. Rob is playing two characters in this podcast. They might actually be the same person. We don't know. So, Rob, I'll go to you first. When did you first see Mulholland Drive?
Oh, man. I think I saw it in university. I'm pretty sure that I rented it from the Sound of Moving Images library. And, you know, I'd already seen, I think, most of Lost Highway at that point. And I just knew that David Lynch was this dark, crazy filmmaker. And I didn't really know what to expect. I just knew that it was going to be, like, intense. I mean, the guy's last name is Lynch, for Christ's sakes. I mean, nobody nice has that name. Right. It's, you know, I mean, I guess David Lynch.
He seems pretty nice.
Yeah, but I mean, it's very dark seeming. The fact that he's nice goes against expectations, which is part of what makes him very weird. But I remember being confounded by this movie. I think that I liked it. I mean, I did like it. I was compelled by it. You know, I would go on to see all of the other David Lynch movies, and, you know, mostly in the theaters. I mean, he very quickly became one of my favorite filmmakers because he is just like that singular vision. And, you know, I've seen it a few times since then. I still don't know what it's about or what happens. Or, you know, maybe I'm starting to get like an idea now after I've seen it for like the fourth time. But
it's about Vietnam, Rob. It couldn't be clearer.
I know, whole allegory I know. There.
But yeah, I mean, I love this movie. I love all of David Lynch's movies. I mean, I feel like pretty much everything he does is like a work of genius. And, you know, he's just, I mean, he's David Lynch. There are few filmmakers whose name become like a description, like Lynchian, right?
Right.
He is like sort of the Salvador Dali of like cinema, of commercial cinema for our generation.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I loved him. I loved all of his movies. I can't believe we're actually talking about a David Lynch movie, because usually we always talk about, like, you know, some crappy movie with teens in it.
Yeah.
Almost ridiculous.
I should say, like, I think we should put a caveat right at the top that this is not going to be a definitive podcast about Mulholland Drive. Like, this is, you know, we do a show where, you know, we're usually talking about, like, Honey, I Blew Up the Kid or some nonsense. So I love this movie. You know, I want to talk about this movie. I want to have a conversation about it. But, you know, I almost don't like doing good movies on this show. And now we're doing a movie that is, by and large, considered a masterpiece.
It's considered one of the best movies of that decade, for sure.
I think it's hard to do good movies on this show because we want to make, you know, we want to make light of things and make jokes and have that. And when you do a good movie, people are going to get really upset that you made fun of Super Mario Brothers.
We're going to have to spend a good 20 minutes making fun of Billy Ray Cyrus if we want to keep the jokes up.
my heart
I'm okay
is
with
in
that.
It.
Your achy breaky
That's,
part?
Yes, exactly.
But I guess I just want to say, like, I know that, you know, we're not going
to
crack every nut. Yeah, like, and again,
no, I have it solved. I figured it all out. Look, it's all
here.
No.
Oh, my God. That looks like serial killer writing. That's amazing.
But also, like, I also wanted to say that in terms of, like, Lynch, like, there are whole podcasts, like, dedicated to Lynch. Like, if you want to get that, you can go, you know, find that. We're just going to have kind of a conversation, I think, about our own feelings about the movie. I'm just, you know, I'm a big Lynch fan, so I would get a little defensive about, I'm worried that this will not be up to snuff. But also, you suggested it, Blaine, and you suggested like a handful of movies, and one of them just happened to be one of my favorite movies, and that doesn't happen often. So I felt like I should jump at it.
Yeah, I mean, this is what's been happening on Rewatchability lately, is we're like, hey, can we watch an okay movie right now? Because we just...
Oh, for sure. I am losing
that
it.
Escapism.
Yeah, exactly. Things are not going well, and I just want to watch movies that I like.
Toronto's still in a lockdown. We're just like, can we just escape a little bit into not a whole bad movie?
I have been accosting the homeless population for tiny blue boxes to escape into.
I'm glad you finished that sentence. Because there's a police report right there. JM, you're a big David Lynch fan. When did you first see Mulholland Drive? Was it one of the first Lynch films you saw? Or
it was. I still saw it in the theater. I think it was opening day, too. I mean, it had played a lot. It's actually the 20th anniversary of when it premiered at Cannes.
That's right.
That's why we're doing
month.
It. Yep,
yeah,
exactly.
Cannes.
Yeah.
But I saw it when it finally opened here in the theater, and I didn't... Yeah, I wasn't, like, a big Lynch fan yet. I'd seen Lost Highway, and I think that was about it. Maybe I'd seen The Straight Story, too. But, you know, I hadn't seen Blue Velvet. I hadn't seen Twin Peaks yet. That was what really opened the world of Lynch up to me. But I just, you know, I kind of saw every big movie, and this one was so acclaimed and, you know, won awards at Cannes and had come to TIFF. And yeah, so I was just excited to go see it. I was trying to think of like just some of the regular sort of nonsensical sort of peripheral details that are typical to our conversations about movies. And the only thing I could think about or think of was when I remember going to see this movie in this shitty multiplex that I still love, this, you know, old theater, and there being an ad at the beginning before the movie had started, like before even the trailers had started, there was an ad for the GameCube, the Nintendo GameCube.
Ooh, nice.
And I think that was the first time I'd seen it. It was a big deal. But then, like, later in the movie, when they pull that little blue cube out of
that's
first,
it's basically the same
thing. Yeah, that was my first thought. I was like, is that the GameCube? Because it looks just like it.
This movie was like The Wizard, but for the GameCube.
Right, yeah.
You think Naomi Watts is Princess Peach?
Oh. No, I mean, I love this movie. I've seen it many times over the years. As recently as just a couple of years ago, I went to the TIFF Lightbox, had a whole Lynch retrospective, and I got to go see this movie and a few others, and this one was like an old beat-up 35mm print, and it was fantastic. But, it is different. It is different watching the movie, even just 2 years ago, watching it theatrically on film and watching it at home. It's even though I was watching it by myself, projected, it was a very different experience. But what about you, Blaine? You suggested this. You must like it.
No, I didn't. I am not a Lynch fan. Not a fan.
Wait. Are you okay? Let's be serious now.
Yeah. No, I know.
Are you doing a bit?
No, I'm not. I'm so sorry.
Oh my God! Yeah. What is happening?
Yeah. So I
is this a dream?
So I saw Twin Peaks when I was younger, and I must have seen like an episode, and it really unsettled me. I didn't like it.
Yeah.
I didn't like it, but like not for the reasons why, like, you know, there is scary stuff out there. Even just the way it was filmed, the soap opera aspect of it, I just really it didn't appeal to any part of the cinema going Blaine that existed then.
Okay. And we've talked about Twin Peaks.
Yeah. And I'd never really seen it. I'd probably seen like half an episode on TV or whatever. Like, it never really was on my radar. People loved it and they would talk about it. And Johnny, who's been on this podcast, was like a big proponent of like, Blaine, you have to see Twin Peaks. It's like, ah.
Can we call Johnny real quick and swap
just replace me on this show? No, there needs to be a counterpoint. There was a counterpoint on Fifth Element, you sons of bitches.
Did you bring this up to get back at us?
No. I had no idea.
Take this, you fuckers. Yeah.
Just lobbing this into the conversation. No, I...
This movie's confusing and stupid.
And
it's kind of the same movie.
Justin Theroux looks dumb.
Kind of the same movie when you think about it. It's just about like a woman with amnesia gets taken home by a stranger.
Oh, my God.
True. Yeah, she sings. No, there's...
Oh, my
well,
God.
Yeah, there's
you're
that
right.
opera singer.
Yeah, there's a lot of parallels. Yeah. There's a lot of parallels.
It's
yeah.
the same thing.
Do you think Ruby Rhodes, whatever his name is the Justin Theroux
character? I think so. Yeah.
He's Billy Ray Cyrus. I think he's Billy Ray Cyrus.
Oh, my God.
We're figuring it out, guys.
Blew my mind.
And the little cube, there's only one in this, but that's the Fifth Element instead of the other four cubes.
This was my tribute to the Fifth Element, which hadn't been made yet, had it?
Yes, it had. Yeah, it came out a few years
ago. Oh, okay. I just love that movie. Sorry, I should have warmed up my David Lynch
impression. I saw it in a dream.
No, that's even further away.
I'm not saying that I have a good David Lynch impression. I'll just do Arnie for David Lynch for the rest of this. So I saw this movie. I was very confused by this movie. I was very bored by this movie when I first saw it.
Oh,
I was
fuck
like, no.
you.
No. I know. Sorry, I know. Sorry. You guys, no, that's the normal reaction.
Everyone's entitled to their opinion.
Right.
But yours is wrong. Yes.
And I don't like you anymore.
That. Okay. We're not friends anymore.
And you smell.
This is the beginning of the end. Aw, that was a low blow.
You do smell. We've been meaning to talk to you about that.
God, even over Zoom, they can tell. But
there's stink lines on the...
Just like waves that go up.
Yeah.
That's my background. Why did I put my background on it like that?
Well,
why
for one thing, obviously everyone can have their own opinion about movies. And, you know, there's a real problem on the internet of people bullying people that don't share their opinion about movies. We're just joking. But also, like, I'm a big Lynch fan, and I'm not uncritical of Lynch. And I have some things to say later about
sure.
The making
of
a movie.
Sure. And, you know, obviously I've seen a lot of movies since university when really, you know, I want to start making them. So I watched a lot more and a lot more like art house stuff, which this probably falls into the realm of. And so, yeah, it was a really great movie for me to rewatch because I knew that it was so critically acclaimed. I really wanted to rewatch it to give it another shot because I'm not the same person that I was back then.
Okay.
But I can...
What's your new name?
I'll be JM from now on.
What?
Oh, yeah, weird.
You have to get another name, JM. So,
oh, are you Blaine now, JM?
What a switch.
I can't believe you don't like this movie.
Yeah, JM, how did you...
Wait, so why did you suggest it?
Because I wanted to rewatch it, to give it another shot. Because I think that's what, you know, this podcast
so you
is
haven't
about.
You haven't seen it since
no.
It came out. Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I, you know, got it on DVD. I watched it in my university house that I lived with 9 people, like just down the street from where I live now. And everyone left the room, I think. And then Johnny lived downstairs and he was like, oh, you watched that? I would have seen that.
You know,
but no one was into it.
I will say it is a different movie in the theater. And I totally mean that.
Sure.
And especially like having seen it when it first came out and then watching it over the years on DVD and then going to see it in the theater again and then watching it now. Like it plays so differently. Like, just in terms of falling into that world, like getting swept up in it because it's, you know, you have no choice. You're in a theater in the dark and you're drawn into that world. And there's also like, even just like formally, like, I don't know if you guys saw this in your research, but like Lynch sent out like a, you know, like a letter to all the projectionists, or, you know, it was like a photocopy letter. Yeah, because he wanted it like framed a specific way because it was shot for TV. But also, like he said, crank the volume by like 3 decibels. And that was another thing I didn't mention about the first time I saw this movie is that scene with the homeless jump scare person.
Oh my God.
Is frightened me like no other movie.
Oh my
had
God.
Done or has done since.
There is no scarier scene in any movie.
No, and also I'd seen it lots of times, and then when I went to see it in the theater again, leading up to that scene, I was like sweating. Like I was so nervous. I almost left because I didn't want to watch it.
He does.
It's almost worse
there.
When you know what's coming.
Yeah,
totally.
The tension is amazing in that scene for sure.
But I think it is different in the theater where it's that loud and that intense and that you have to commit that focus to it. You know, not even saying like you missed something. I'm just saying in terms of like the vibe you get from the movie is a little different.
And you know, there are movies like that. I did start watching this movie on my phone late at night, like while in bed.
Oh,
and then
Rob, do you have Johnny's number?
No, I'll call him.
But then I had to stop and rewatch it from the beginning on my screen at home.
You know, but, there's even like that famous video of Lynch being like, you can't watch a movie on a fucking phone.
Yeah.
I saw that on my phone.
Yeah. So, no, I do get that it would be more involving in the theater. But let's get into it. Rob, do you want to do the rundown of this very disconnected film?
I don't think I can.
Yeah, it's hard.
It's, there's a lot. There's a lot. I mean,
we can just do it kind of...
No. I can do it. You know. Okay. I mean, first of all, if you haven't seen this movie, it is going to get weird. So, you know,
I think you're gonna want to see this movie after this because you're gonna be like, what the hell were they talking about? It has to make more sense than that.
No. First of all, everyone has seen this movie. Second of all, this movie makes perfect sense.
It does. It does. I think that it does. Okay. I mean, it starts with about 5 to 6 minutes of dancing.
That's the stuff that I watched on my phone, and I was like, I can stop watching now and go to sleep and have nightmares already.
Do people dancing and having fun scare you, Blaine?
It's the way it was done. All overlapped and like the...
It was pretty creepy.
Betty.
You're right. It's the creepiest thing in this whole movie.
Right. And then we see a car driving down a dark highway. And also, there's a lot of other images. It's all very surreal as it starts. But eventually, after a very long time, and it feels like a very long time, we get into the car with this woman, Laura Herring, in the back, you know, being driven. And the limousine stops. And she says, we're not supposed to stop here. And then... the guys at the front pull a gun on her and order her to get out of the limo. So it seems like they're going to murder this woman. But at that exact moment, some crazy kids are driving down the highway like a maniac. There's like two vehicles, and they just happen to come around the bend at the same time, and they crash into this vehicle, and it's a big accident. And then this woman emerges from the wreckage and in a daze begins like getting away from it. And she sort of wanders down into the city, and she finds herself in this like community. And there she sort of sneaks into this person's house just as that person is taking off with all of her bags. And so she just basically hides out there. She doesn't know what's happening, it seems like. She just has an instinct to find somewhere to be safe. Then we have Naomi Watts. She plays Betty, and she is just arriving in Los Angeles, Hollywood, California. And she is just a small town girl from a little town in Ontario called Deep River. And
Rob, aren't you from Deep River?
No, I'm from a different small town. Okay.
Shallow Grave, they called it.
Shallow Grave, yeah. Nice place. But she is just arriving in town, and she is following her big dreams of being a Hollywood actress. I mean, you know, it's a dream, but she has to try. And she's telling, like, the two old people that she just happens to be riding with everything. And then they say goodbye. And her, like, face is, like, super washed out by, like, the brightness of this town. It's, like, It's just everything. And so she goes to her aunt's place where she's going to be staying. And she meets the superintendent, Coco. And it seems like a nice place. A little weird. It's a little bit like, you know, kooky Hollywood. So, you know, but okay. And checks out her aunt's place. And she finds a naked woman in the shower. I mean, to be fair, when you find somebody in the shower, you expect them to be naked. Yes. But you don't expect.
It would be creepier if she was fully clothed in the shower.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Missed opportunity.
She doesn't expect to find this person there. And she's a little bit confounded. Like, oh, my aunt didn't say anything about anybody staying here. And she asked this person her name, and this person doesn't even seem to know. And she just happens to, like, you know, see a poster of Rita Hayworth. And so she says, my name's Shawshank. Rita. <Yeah. laughs> Naomi Watts is like, well, what happened? I mean, she still thinks that she's a friend of her aunt's. And then, like, the aunt calls, and there's some confusion there. And, you know, we're not really sure what's happening.
So that whole thread is like them trying to figure out who she is, because she kind of admits that she doesn't know who she is.
Right? Yeah.
That whole thread, yeah.
Eventually, yeah. Now, there's also there's some sketchy stuff with, like, weird dudes. Like, first of all, we have the backwards talking guy. He's doing something, and a bunch of people seem to work for him.
I mean, the backwards talking guy from Twin Peaks. He's not talking backwards in this.
No, that's true. Right. Yeah. But there aren't many other backwards talking guys.
It's a guy from Tenet, but that's it.
It's Michael Anderson from Twin Peaks, but he's wearing this, like, prosthetic body.
Right.
Yeah, so it's. And in this kind of, like, curtained room with, like, a intercom.
It's like the Brown Lodge.
Yeah. Yeah. Which sounds pretty gross, not going to lie.
Oh, yeah.
Where are you staying?
Better name for that.
I'm tucked up in the Brown Lodge. You don't want to go there.
Yeah.
The Tapioca Lodge.
The Tapioca, yeah. And, yeah, they are trying to get this movie director played by Justin Theroux in a pair of glasses to put this woman in
glasses.
His movie. Yeah. And also, his
Hardly
hair is like
him.
Is like gelled back, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
He kind of looks like, do you guys remember the Canadian Idol guy? Ryan Malcolm, is that his name?
Yes.
I think so.
Oh, yeah. He opened for my band once, that guy.
Whoa!
And that... Yeah.
How was he?
I think he was fine. But it just made me think, like,
how the mighty have fallen. How the semi-mighty have fallen.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there's a reason Justin Theroux's hair is like that, so, you know, Tell you that later on in the behind the scenes.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right. But yeah, he doesn't want to put this actress that they want him to put in the movie, And it's a great scene. Like, there's these two big guys, and one of them is Dan Hedaya, and one of the guys orders an espresso. Well,
you know who the other guy is, right?
I do. It's Angelo Badalamonte, yeah. The composer.
So he's
intimidating.
He's great, man. Yeah.
You don't want to mess with him.
Yeah, well, they insist on putting this person in the movie, and it seems like it'd be a bad idea to not do it. And
I think that guy just doesn't like espresso, because when it's brought to him, he just spits it out, and that guy's like, it's the best espresso in the world.
I love that.
I think he just keeps on trying to find a good espresso, and is like, I think they all taste like this.
It's funny that he's not an actor, because he's so good in it. Like, yeah, he's just like, funny. Napkin.
I'm sorry. That was a highly recognized...
That is considered one of the finest espressos in the world,
what
sir.
Is going on here?
There is no way that girl is in my movie.
Nazi!
This is the girl.
Hey, that girl is not in my film.
It's no longer your film.
Well, David Lynch is great at getting...
Oh, totally. And you know what's weird? We're jumping ahead a little bit, but this whole storyline with Justin Theroux being bullied by these shadowy, otherworldly kind of mobster guys into casting an actress in the movie that he doesn't want to cast. The actress is called Camilla Rhodes, and in this sort of portion of the movie, she's played by Melissa George, who is currently starring with Justin Theroux in The Mosquito Coast, which I just watched like the first two episodes of the other day.
Oh, I just watched it's pretty good. I'm liking it.
It's okay. But it's just it's just weird that I watched that and I was like, I'm going to watch another Justin Theroux movie, and then forgetting that she played that character.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, there's all these bit parts for major actors in this movie. I loved it. Was kind of like, you know, stargazing, just spotting everyone.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Because there's also a scene. Keep in mind, I just watched Lost, where Jacob from Lost randomly like kills a guy.
Yeah,
and then in order because somebody he accidentally shoots through the wall and hits this woman, and it doesn't kill her, so he has to like
something bit me good.
So good.
That actress is she's not an I don't know if she's an actress, but
she's in a movie.
She's so good.
She's amazing.
She's great. That whole scene is hilarious, not just because it's Jacob from Lost, but like that he has to keep like
it feels so Coen Brothers-esque. Like it just like
totally.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like thinking on his feet, like, "Hey, buddy, you have to help me with her. Like, come into the room. Like, help me." I just love that whole scene. It was so brilliant.
Oh yeah, did you guys see who that the guy with the vacuum cleaner is? Do you know who that is?
No.
Apparently, it's Michael J. Fox's stunt double from Back to the Future.
Of course, I don't know why I didn't notice that.
Yeah,
he looks exactly like Marty McFly. Come on,
everyone should have known that. Just Doc? Looking at him, you know.
I just found that random.
Yeah, yeah, no, that was pretty random.
Yeah, he should have hoverboarded right out of there.
And then there's those. Did we talk about the two guys in the diner that see the?
Well, I mean, we referenced them, but I mean, it's the guy, it's that guy who's in everything.
Yeah.
Patrick Fischler, is that his name?
That's his name,
Patrick Fischler,
And he just basically, he's talking to a guy, and he says, I had this terrible nightmare where I saw something out back, and I saw the most terrifying face that I'd ever seen, and I just never want to see that face again. And the guy's like, all right, let's go out back. And then he's like, oh, man. And then there's just like the sweat on this guy, on Fischler's face, and just like the tension. He looks like he's, you know, going to choke. And then we see the most horrifying face ever on celluloid or whatever. And I think Patrick Fischler dies.
Yeah,
he just
like
dies.
The actual actor, he died that day.
He died.
Yeah.
Luckily, he'd already filmed all of those iconic performances well in advance.
Yeah,
Mad Men and Lost. And... And
I mean, it's just, it's an amazing scene. It's crazy.
The character, I mean, I feel bad saying this, but it's what the character is credited as Bum, which is not the most sensitive way of, you know, describing. No. I mean, let's just put it out there. David Lynch hates homeless people. He keeps putting
them actual monsters. Terrified.
Is that why you're a fan, JM? Because you accost homeless people?
No, but this Bum character is played by Bonnie Ahrens, who, do you recognize her, guys?
No.
She is also...
She sings Total Eclipse of the Heart.
No.
I didn't recognize her as female.
Well, she's in lots of stuff, but she plays... She plays the nun in the Conjuring movies.
Conjuring 2,
and then the nun movie. And yeah, I remember reading an interview with her years ago where she talked about being in Mulholland Drive and just meeting David Lynch and being like, wow, he's hot. It's just so fun. It was so funny to me. Like, this scene was so scary as a kid, just thinking like, wow,
that
character was like into the director.
Oh man, can you imagine that?
Like, those were her sexy bedroom eyes.
Yeah, like that's what I'm imagining. Like him giving her direction and her being like, okay, but like give me more direct, like flirting with him in that get up.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Like,
he's like, you're a monster. She's like, oh, stop. That's great. Yeah, and then we get more of like that kind of main storyline where she even shows up to the Justin Theroux's movie that he's casting.
Well, she is auditioning because she wants to be this actress, and her aunt got her an audition for this movie. And, you know, we see her rehearse it with Rita, and it's fine. You know, it seems like it's good. And then she goes in and does the audition. And, I mean, it's a very creepy situation. There's all these, like, you know, very paternal old men, and they're, like, treating her like a little child. And, like, the old guy has, like, his hand on, like, Naomi Watts's, like, the small of her back, sort of, like, leading her. It's all very creepy. And then she has to do this, like, scene.
But she also pushes it against, like, he kind of, like, has his hand in the air during the scene, but I think that was before.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, the actor wants to play it real close, right? Like, wants it to be very hot, right? And you sort of get, like, the idea that this is, like, a little bit of, like, a thrill for all of the men.
Yeah, and he's, like, really old and, like, really tan. Like,
yeah, like, the way he whitened his teeth was by getting a darker tan. Like, you can just tell that's what he did. Yeah, it's creepy. But then she, like, leans into it, and...
She nails it.
It's a performance that probably landed Naomi Watts the rest of the movies in her career. Like, it's such a great performance that she does in that scene. It's great.
You're playing a dangerous game here. If you're trying to blackmail me, it's not going to work.
You know what I want. It's not that difficult.
Well, it's also like, you know, this is, you know, obvious, but like this adds to like the surreality of the whole thing, because it's the rest of her performance as Betty in this part of the movie is very like over the top and like gee whiz and, you know, like a character in the 50s or something. And then like the realest moment we spend with her at this point is in a scene where she's pretending and where she's playing a fictional character.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
And it's also a really creepy scene. Like, it doesn't say exactly what it is, but it seems like maybe Naomi Watts is playing a character who is underage and who is having like some sort of like relationship with this older guy. And, you know, there's talk about, you know, he'll get in trouble if anybody hears about it.
Right. Yeah. No, it's Creepsville all around.
But there is a cool casting director who is a lady, and she is not as creepy as those guys. And she sees what a great job Naomi Watts does and wants to get her into audition for this other movie. Mm-hmm. So they're going to bring her over to the set, and this is where Adam, Justin Theroux's character, is, you know, doing the auditions. And at first he didn't want to do it. And he actually like went a little bit crazy with a golf club on the guy's limousine. But after speaking to a cowboy, stay with me here. He is convinced to cast the actress that they want, and that's the big problem. Like they shut down the movie, they fired all the people, and then they sort of like put him. They sort of made him go on the run. Like yeah. They canceled all his credit cards. They took all the money out of his bank account somehow. He goes to a hotel, and the guy just tells him it's not safe for you here. You basically have to go. So he basically has no choice, and the cowboy's like, how many drivers does a buggy have? And then Justin Theroux's like, one, I think. And then sometimes there's a guy beside that. But that's shock. Okay, one.
This scene is amazing, though. I love this scene.
It's so great.
It's so eerie. I mean, it's, you know, one thing I think that is partly what made this movie so accessible in terms of like the Lynchy weirdness of it all is the fact that you have a character like the Justin Theroux character,
right,
who knows that it's weird. Yeah, like he's reacting like you would if you were thrown into a David Lynch. Like he knows that it's weird that he's going to see a guy called the cowboy who acts like the cowboy. And that's great. And this whole scene is so creepy and so weird. That guy who plays the cowboy, Monty Montgomery, is not an actor. He's a producer. Like he produced Wild at Heart, and David Lynch just forced him to be in this scene. Like he didn't even want to do it, and he insisted that he come do it. He didn't even know his lines. They had to tape his lines onto Justin Theroux, so he's reading it all kind of like weirdly and kind of stiffly because he's just
how many
yeah.
drivers.
And everyone was like, "What? This is fucking crazy!" Like, what? And then you see it in the context, and it's perfect. Like, it's amazing.
Man's attitude goes some ways. The way his life will be. Is that something you might agree with?
Sure.
Now, did you answer because that's what you thought I wanted to hear, or did you think about what I said and answer because you truly believe that to be right?
I agree with what you said. Truly.
What'd I say?
That a man's attitude determines to a large extent how his life will be.
So since you agree, you must be a person who does not care about the good life.
Oh, it's crazy. It's crazy good. I mean, yeah, everything in this movie, there's so many moments of like sublimeness, of sublimity that in this film, like that is one of them. Like that scene, just so much weirdness, and also the Club Silencio thing. It's all, I mean, that's what David Lynch is so good at. But so she doesn't end up auditioning for this movie, but we do see him sort of accept that this person, you know, what's her name?
Who?
The actress that they want to get in the movie.
Betty? Oh, Camilla Rhodes?
Yeah, he accepts the Camilla Rhodes person, and so he's going to do this movie. But this is where it gets weird.
This is where it gets weird.
I know what you're thinking. There's going to be more dancing. No, there's not more dancing. But, well, I mean, she... Rita starts to have some sort of memories of her thing. Some memories start to appear. So she remembers Mulholland's. They go and check out Mulholland. She remembers the name Diane Selwyn. Something.
They phone Selwyn. Her. Yeah.
Yeah, and they, you know, she's not there. So they go and visit her, and they can't find her. But somebody lets her into the apartment. And so they go up there.
They break into the apartment.
And they find her dead.
They find her dead. They find her body lying in bed.
Yeah.
She's very, very dead. And that's not cool. And also, there's like a whole bunch of money in Rita's purse. Forgot to mention that. And a blue key that is really weird looking. And yeah. But so they go home and they get a little bit, they get a little bit intimate. I mean, they are staying together, and Naomi Watts invites Rita to sleep in the bed instead of the couch, and they're saying goodnight, and they kiss, And then they have some intimacy.
Intimate time.
And then some sexy times.
And then she wakes up. Oh, okay. You wanted to hang on this moment. I'm sorry.
Well, I don't know. Should we talk about it? Is it noteworthy?
I mean, it was noteworthy to critics at the time. They were saying how this was like the best lesbian relationship ever put to film, which at that time might have been true.
If you just like ignored like all of LGBT cinema.
Yeah, exactly. That came out in the 80s and 90s and stuff. And even before that, there were, anyway. But yeah, I think people were looking into this as kind of the guiding star of all LGBTQ cinema, where I don't know if that's the case.
I think it is necessary to the story, and necessary for Lynch's purposes, because mm-hmm. I mean, we're going to talk about this a lot later, but like obviously this was, or not obviously, but famously, this was a TV pilot, and
right.
We'll talk about this maybe a little more in the behind-the-scenes stuff, but like this was a TV pilot that was completed as a movie, and they filmed new stuff for the movie, obviously this being one of those scenes. And I think that like when Lynch had his idea of how it should end and where the story should go, and have it kind of focusing on this as a romantic relationship, but he had, you know, 2 hours of story up till then where they're not romantic, where they're just friends, like they're close mm-hmm. friends, or they have a budding friendship in the pilot, but they're not there's nothing romantic going on. So I think he realized that he had this place where he wanted to go, and he had all of this leading up to it, and he needed something to connect those two. And so to have one scene pull that off, it needed to be something graphic and potent and romantic and powerful. Mm-hmm. And I think he, you know, probably pulled it off, gauging from how everyone has reacted to it over the years. But like, I think that's why the scene is so like, it's kind of sudden. And yeah, like we said, like it goes straight to it. Like it doesn't, mm-hmm. doesn't take its time really. And it does have, you know, I mean, in a lesser filmmaker's hands, like it probably would have been criticized as being exploitative. I mean, we could have that conversation anyways, because, you know, Lynch certainly isn't immune from those criticisms, I don't think. But I think it mostly pulls it off. But I think it was out of necessity. I think it was like, we need something big here to propel us to this place where I want the story to go.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. I mean, it feels a little bit male-gazy, and I think that, like, a lot of times in David Lynch's movies, he does present women as various, like, archetypes, as, you know, representing various things to various people, but he's also, like, playing with that and sort of, he always counteracts that. Like, for example, like if you're talking about Twin Peaks, like Laura Palmer, you know, could be such a problematic character, and you know, there are lots of ways to talk about how it is, but he also, like, she remains the focus of the series through the entire thing. Yeah. Like,
and
there's
the
so
movie.
Much like care for the character and the movie, and like, you know, the return, like it's all about her, and it all goes back to like to her, you know. And you know, so I think that, I don't know. Like I think that he plays with it, and you know, it does sort of go, it sort of veers into like maybe like it's a little bit exploitative, a little bit male gazy, but also like it is really potent, and it's a really powerful performance by both of those actors as well.
There was one kind of gross detail that Laura Herring, and you know, she speaks super highly of him, and everyone, you know, who works with him loves him.
Are you talking about the touch breasts more? Are you talking about that?
No, I didn't know that.
Oh, okay.
Oh, well, it definitely seems like he says that. It's like he's very... Lynch is definitely a breast man,
well,
let's put it that way.
Yeah, Herring said that in her trailer she was shaking, crying, like very, very afraid of doing this scene. And then when she did it, you know, the last take, the director, Lynch, coming up to her and being like, you should probably touch your breasts a lot more. And then they used that take. And it just spoke. I mean, I don't think that there was anything nefarious going on, but it just spoke to the fact that it's such a good thing that there's intimacy people on sets now, like, to handle that stuff, because it's hard. It's hard for actors to go through.
The thing I was referring to was that she said, like, yeah, she was super nervous. And also, like, it's a hard position to be in because, like, they made this TV pilot. And then they basically came to them and said, you know, we're turning it into a movie, but now there's all this nudity. And it's like, do you, you know, give up the chance to have, like, your work actually seen and come to fruition? Or, you know, whatever. But, like, the story she told was that she was super nervous to do that scene. And Lynch was like, don't worry, like, the set's going to be really dark. And she's like, okay. And then they, like, filmed a few takes, and then he, like, yells to, like, the lighting guy, like, pump it up. And they, like, you know, made it, like, way brighter all of a sudden.
Right.
But I mean, he also did things like, she said that, like, he kind of, like, blurred her pubic region for, like, the DVD and stuff, because, you know, he said he wouldn't show that, or, you know, he did do some things like that to make it more comfortable. But there were some stories about that. The other thing, like, you know, maybe we'll get to when we talk about it, but, like, the masturbation scene that Naomi Watts has to do, like, that she was actually, like, really angry about the way that was filmed.
Right.
But I mean, still speaks of him reverently and loves him. But,
yeah.
You know.
Says they're good friends.
Okay, so Naomi Watts turns into Diane.
Well, first they go to the club, and
they go to the Silencio. They get the box. They put the
Silencio thing.
Start playing the GameCube. Super Smash Brothers. It's great.
During the club Silencio performance, Naomi Watts sort of goes into some sort of, like, seizure or like something. She's shaking and, you know, having an experience. And she also said something to, like, to Rita about, like, let me do this for you, or something like that. But anyway, so then she wakes up as this other person, and you sort of see this other story. And it's sort of unclear when it's happening, but in it, her and Rita are also lovers. So it parallels the other timeline. But Rita's character, who we find out is Camilla.
They say Camilla. I said Camilla, but it's
but she is breaking off the relationship. She doesn't want to fool around anymore, and, you know, she is getting in with Adam, the film director, and she's in this movie. You know, as we've seen, she's been cast and all of that. And
we forgot to talk about Billy Ray Cyrus. I can't.
We'll get to him.
Fuck. Oh my god! But it happened like an hour ago in the movie.
Okay. So Adam goes home to find out that Billy Ray has replaced him as the man of the household. The pool boy is now with his wife,
and now he has an achy breaky. I'm not going to finish that joke. Okay, sorry.
It really came in like a wrecking ball, a home wrecking
ball.
But
that was apparently Lynch just, like, heard him on the radio or something. It was like, that guy should play Gene the Pool Guy.
This song's catchy. Yeah.
Put him in there. Yeah, so then, sucked in this next world, and we see that their kind of, like, relationship is disintegrating, right?
Yeah, and, you know, it seems like Camilla is still sort of, like, leading her along. Like, you know, they had, like, this sexual or romantic relationship.
She invites her to that party. Like, why?
Invites her to this party and all of this stuff. And it's driving Diane a little crazy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's really upsetting her. She's, like, crying. So she talks to Jacob from Lost.
Yeah.
And it seems like she's going to put out a hit on this person. And when it happens, then there'll be a blue key on her coffee table. And so then she sees this blue key, and she's really sad. And then the old people...
What about A minor? Naomi, that's a blue key.
And then the old people who Naomi Watts showed up in L.A. with, very tiny versions of them pop out of the GameCube. And then they sort of, like, scurry, scurry, scurry,
under
scurry.
Under the door.
under the door, and then they become full size somehow. Yeah. But then they like
they probably got water on them or ate after midnight.
I went for Ant-Man. Okay. Yours is better. Yours is better.
They chase Diana, and she can only escape by going into the bedroom and shooting herself and committing suicide.
And then she's the body in the bed that the neighbor discovers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's where it ends.
Yeah.
That's the end of the movie.
No, there's the blue-haired woman at the club.
Oh, that's right. She says, yes, the blue-haired woman at the club says, silencio.
Yeah.
And we will soon be silencio after after we come back from this break.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found. That project manager I could never seem to hire? And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome back to Rewatchability. We're talking about the easily understood and much maligned Mulholland
Drive.
It's
not maligned by anybody. It's people say it's the best film of the 21st
You're
century.
You're the maligner.
Guys, I said easily understood before that. It was all sarcastic.
Oh, okay.
All right.
You know who, I did want to say, you know who that blue-haired woman at the end is in Club Silencio?
No. Marge Simpson?
No, she's the script supervisor.
Oh, my God.
And like when they were filming in that theater and Lynch just had this idea and he ran up to someone and said, like, how quickly can you get a blue wig? and convinced her to do it, even though she's not.
It'd be great
actress.
If she just pulled one out of her back pocket, like, blue wig right now. That's how fast I can get a blue wig.
Well, okay, I mean, it worked with Twin Peaks, just putting crew members in key roles.
Yeah. Right. Was Bob a crew member?
Yeah.
Is that like
he was?
Guy? Yeah.
Yeah, same also, if you want to become an actor, just be in a David Lynch
pretty
crew.
Much. Yeah, get on set.
Work boom.
Okay, so question number one, what movies constitute David Lynch's Los Angeles trilogy?
What?
Well, Inland Empire.
Okay.
This one.
Yeah.
Lost Highway, I guess.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, question two. In this movie, we're told that Aunt Ruth is making a movie in Canada. What alternate meaning does this phrase have in Hollywood?
Oh, is she drying out?
Close.
Her dead?
Yeah, dead. The death of a career, which is drying out, which is not. I mean, I guess not drying out, but
well, that's yeah. Some people have like
death of the party.
Theorized that Anne Ruth is dead if she exists.
Yeah, somehow. Exactly. But
that's tricky.
That's what Hollywood thinks of the Canadian film system. So good on you, Hollywood. And then question number three. Which actor was self-described doing so badly in their career in 1998 that they were not a voice in this movie, but only credited as an additional voice with no name in Babe, Pig in the City?
Wait, what?
What?
Which actor in this movie was they said they were doing so bad in their career they couldn't get a job, and the only job they could get was being an additional voice on Babe, Pig in the City?
Well, I'm gonna guess Naomi Watts because she's Australian.
Yeah. I know she was also having a hard time.
Yeah, she was. It was Naomi Watts. She was saying, "I wasn't getting put in parts. I was giving myself away. My soul was being destroyed. David changed that." He was truly interested, took the time to unravel layers. So Naomi Watts is like super interesting.
She's great.
She's so great.
She's really good. She didn't get her break in this movie till she was 32. So she like she wasn't even going to audition for this. She had flown out to LA for a movie role the year before where literally the casting director and the director in the room fell asleep during her audition. So she was like, I'm not going to fly out to LA for this goddamn David Lynch movie where he's not going to cast me anyway. And then she was told by her agent that David Lynch saw her headshot and had picked her out, and she was the only one auditioning for this. So she was like, oh, okay, I'll go for that.
David Lynch's casting style seems to be like, I saw a pretty girl, and I think she would be a fantastic actress. Well,
he also, he said he was disappointed when he met her because, she wasn't wearing makeup. And so she had to audition again wearing makeup, so she looked more like the picture that he saw that he liked.
God, and the picture that he saw that was taken, she credits her brother getting her role because the brother took the photograph. And David Lynch was like, there's something about your eyes in that photograph. And when you zoom in on the photograph, you can see her brother taking the picture. So she was like, there's someone in my eyes.
I thought you were going to say you see Bob.
Her brother Charlie Watts.
It was just Bob. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, I've seen that picture. It just looks like an ordinary snapshot.
Yeah, it doesn't. Yeah, it's not crazy.
Well, the other thing about that and Lynch's style is he doesn't audition people with scripts. They don't come in and read scenes. He literally just talks to people. And which is kind of, you might think is insane, but look at how that helped with this project, because if he had auditioned people who were just perfect for the Betty part, a year or two later, when you're completely overhauling the reality of your script and have the Diane character, which is, a complete 180, if you're kind of locked into someone that's this whole other character type, that might not have worked. But obviously he saw something in Naomi Watts and wanted to work with her, and she obviously nails it. I mean, she's amazing in this movie.
Yeah, she is amazing. Yeah, and she hated the Betty character. She was like, it's so flat and one-dimensional, I hated playing it. And it wasn't until it became a film, as you said, JM, this was an ABC pilot that Lynch filmed, and then one exec saw it and was like, no one else watched this, it's trash, and they threw it out. And he said the exec who saw it watched it at 6 a.m. having coffee standing up, which apparently is the bad way to watch it. I don't know, but that was like the detail.
I've seen him say that in multiple interviews. He's like, and the guy watched it before he'd had breakfast. It was 6 a.m. He's standing up. He's taking phone calls across the room. he doesn't know all of this. He probably heard the guy watch it in the morning and extrapolated.
Exactly.
Can you imagine this being for network television, and there's the diner scene with the scary homeless person, and then
watch
it cuts to a Burger King commercial?
It's online. I've seen it. Have you guys watched it?
David Lynch hates that version. He's like, don't see it.
Well, it's
awful.
He especially hates it because he shot 2 hours or so. Basically the first 2 hours of the movie are the pilot. Mm-hmm. But then the version that's online, the version he cut for ABC was 90 minutes. So the 90-minute version that you can find online, this the same VHS rip that he gave to the network or whatever, is it's weird. It's weird to watch because it feels a TV show. I don't think the scene in the diner is in there. It was filmed for that. It was probably in the 2-hour version. It's not in the 90-minute version, I don't think. But the scene with the homeless character holding the cube as I think the last moment in the pilot. But there's also there's weird differences between the pilot and the finished version, especially in terms of music. I remember in the audition scene where it's her and the guy, and it's really intense and realistic when it gets to that intimate moment. I remember the score comes in the pilot. Whereas in the movie, I think they play it totally, with no score, and it's more powerful in the theater. I don't know if it would have worked on television, but it's an interesting to watch. And there are a few scenes in the pilot that aren't in the movie. There's another scene with Robert Forster and his detective pal. There's a scene with Justin Theroux's buddy. He's gonna crash with. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting to watch, but it's not great.
Yeah. So there are 10 clues David Lynch gave to European audiences when he thought it was just gonna be released as a movie in Europe, with Canal Plus's $7 million funding to make it a movie.
Before we get to the clues, I do just want to say something quickly about the transitioning of the pilot to a movie, because it is an insane story. And the thing that I find so funny about it is what everybody kind of heralds as being like, you know, what makes Mulholland Drive a great movie is this sort of like reality busting, you know, the switch between the Betty character, the Diane character, like the blurring of dreams and reality. It's, you know, it seems like both are dreams to some people and reality to others, and not to other people and other parts of it. But you know, that whole kind of twist or change or development is what makes this movie, part of what makes this movie so great. And that was because of the behind the scenes story of this movie. So it was this pilot. Lynch kind of just left it behind. His friend at what was the studio? Studio Canal or whatever.
Canal Plus in French.
Yeah. He came to him and said, like, let's turn it into a movie. And that was a whole process. And basically they ironed out all the details, got, you know, they had to like pay Disney all this money for the pilot. They had to organize all these deals for the actors, and because, you know, they were paid different rates for TV than they would have for a film. They got it all kind of ready. And then Lynch found out that ABC had thrown out all the sets. The sets had been destroyed and all the props and costumes had just been kind of like reintegrated into the studio system, so they couldn't track them down. And so Lynch didn't want to do it anymore. And he didn't even have an idea for how to finish it, but he knew he couldn't do it without the props and the costumes. And then basically the guy who had developed the project with him, who had kind of had a falling out with him, persuaded, you know, was so upset that Lynch was flaking out on it after they'd done all this work, convinced Disney to threaten to sue Lynch if he backed out of making Mulholland Drive, because they had this deal in place to like buy the pilot for like, you know, $4-5 million or whatever it was. So he got Disney to threaten to sue him. So Lynch was basically forced to do this by the Walt Disney Company. I mean, he credits, he says it was like
the mouse cracked the whip,
which inadvertently gave us this great movie. I mean, Lynch said like he came up with how to finish it through, you know, obviously through meditating, which is his, you know, creative process. But I think it's really funny that this like artistic genius flourish of, you know, switching realities is what we love about this movie. But it's what a guy had to do to figure out how do I finish this story when all of the sets and costumes have been thrown out? And if I don't make it, I will be sued by one of the most powerful corporations on Earth. I think that's kind of amazing.
That's a pretty great story. Yeah, yeah.
That's amazing. It all works. It all like fits. Like the what he did to solve that problem is amazing. And I don't fault it, but I think it's hilarious that that is the reason why we got the Mulholland Drive that we know.
Wow. It's mind-blowing. It's mind-blowing that like one of the most amazing movies of cinema history started out as a TV show on ABC.
Yeah.
And then it was just sort of like, yeah, it was just sort of finished because he had to. That's amazing. It's like if somebody forced somebody to finish like Citizen Kane. It's like Orson Welles, just like done with it.
Yeah.
It's like, come on, just finish it up.
And
man.
Put a sled in it. It's fine.
The sled's Rosebud.
Yeah, just put a sled in it. Just do it.
People do tend to think that it began as a spinoff of Twin Peaks.
That's what Charlotte Fenn said?
Yeah, that's not actually true. It was just the name Mulholland Drive was going to be used for a spinoff about the Audrey character, so coming to Hollywood. So
that makes
sense. Wasn't actually the same story.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're going to wrap up here real quick, but there are 10 clues that David Lynch gave.
I've got them right here.
Look
at that on the DVD.
Better.
We're not going to read through them or anything. We'll leave that to you. But people online have said that all these kind of clues point towards the whole beginning, and tell me if I'm getting this right, the whole beginning of this movie, the 2 hours that were kind of filmed for the pilot, being a dream that Naomi Watts' character in that alternate reality is having. So she's getting kind of, she kills her lover and then kills herself. And in that flash before she dies, she has this whole kind of alternate life that she lives where she has everything and that she wants, and she becomes the actress and everything. Even Justin Theroux, the director, is made to give her, like, all these things are kind of set in place for her.
I mean, I think that's the more obvious kind of interpretation. Okay. I mean, you even see, like, you know, there's the shot of the pillow at the beginning before the movie even starts. I mean, you can read it that way. What I think is more interesting is the fact that, like, both realities seem more real than the other for different reasons. I mean, like, the sort of what you, in that interpretation, you take as the dream seems more real because that was the pilot. Like, that was the story. Like, so, and then the way that Lynch films, you know, what would quote unquote be the real part is much more dreamlike. It's much more rushed and has all these strange transitions. So I think, yeah, that's on the right track, but I don't think it's that cut and dried.
Yeah. Okay.
And that was, fair enough. This list of clues was something that the studio asked him to do, and he was kind of like, I don't really like doing that, but I'll put some vague things in.
Yeah. And Naomi Watts and Justin Theroux both said in different ways that, you know, a Lynchian film is meant to be dissected and enjoyed and come to different conclusions for each individual viewer. You know, it's not like one thing that he's trying to get across, because even in that there's things that go against it, you know, like, you know, the Bible, if you read that, there's all these things and then they contradict each other, and I feel like there's a lot of contradictions in this movie which almost, you know, negate trying to figure it out in a way.
But it does, you know, it does,
it's better than
it
the
does
Bible.
Answer more questions than even like you would expect necessarily
than Lost.
Yeah. Yeah, and like Jacob answers more questions than, well, like, because I mean, like,
is this part of the Lost?
There's a mysterious
universe?
Blue key, and then they spell out the blue key for us. You know, there's a purse full of money. We have a purse full of money mirror. Like, I mean, that kind of call and response between clues, I think, is like pretty specific. And I like that.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, it's very straightforward.
Yeah, exactly.
You know. Mm-hmm. It's like the most straightforward of any of David Lynch's.
Well,
anything.
Maybe that's why it got such large attention, because it was one of the more accessible David Lynch movies out there. But let's go around and say if we found it rewatchable. Rob, I'm going to start with you.
Yeah, I mean,
he loves it, folks.
I would rewatch it again anytime. It's an amazing film. I think it's like a cinematic achievement. David Lynch, he is a genius, you know? He makes it work. And, like, you can be critical of him. He is a ridiculous person. He does have his, like, he has his favorite themes and tropes. He loves, like, stuff from the 50s. He sort of, like, is half, like, stuck in this ideal, you know, of the 50s, which is very, like, you know, the family, you know, the patriarchy, you know, women are pretty, men, you know, are tough. And all of that stuff. But then also, like, he shows us the dark side of that so well. And, I mean, his movies are just amazing. And this one is a masterpiece. It's a fucking masterpiece. And this guy has made probably, like, 4 or 5 masterpieces. Dune.
To start with.
No. Yeah. But just, seriously, I mean, like, this is an amazing film. Like, there's no... You could rewatch this 1,000 times. I think there would still be great stuff to find in it. You would still have like an amazing experience. It's so experiential. Mm-hmm. He's the guy who makes cinema so exciting, you know, for I think a lot of people, because he really plays with the conventions and everything, and he makes everything like inexplicably wondrous, you know, and also frightening.
Yeah, I mean, it's terrifying. I'm so glad I picked this, Rob. This is so great. I didn't know how much you loved this movie. That's amazing.
And it's also funny. Like, I think that's also what, like, spoke to me as, like, a 14-year-old or whatever. Like, it's a very funny movie. Like, he's got a good sense of humor. All of his movies have something comedic in it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, he's hilarious. I mean, yeah, he's such a character. I mean, David Lynch is a character, and I love the character of David Lynch. So, totally rewatchable. All right. One of the most rewatchable movies.
JM, I think I know what you're going to say, but say it.
I love this movie, obviously. I'm a Lynch fan. I mean, like I said before, like, I'm not going to not criticize him if I feel like it. I mean, I was also watching this movie thinking a lot about directors and like on-set working environments. I think partly because I'm writing an article right now about James Cameron. A couple of articles, actually.
Oh, God.
And I was reading the a Abyss? Lot about, yeah, like his work on The Abyss and like Titanic and just Jesus. Like how, you know, he treats like movie sets like a war. And like he'll say that and he's just screaming at people and it's awful and everyone's, you know, unhappy. Whereas Lynch, like, it seems like he, you know, he works a lot with the same actors and he seems to just have like a great vibe and everyone. He's got this air about him like he, you know, just women adore him and
right.
And men just want to like if either adore him or just want to like hang out with him. Like, I mean, there's something magnetic about him. He's like a guru or something.
He is. He's. So
but
crazy.
He's not beyond. You know, like yeah, like the scene with where he's filming the masturbation scene. Like Naomi Watts kept asking him to like cut, and he wouldn't, and she was really uncomfortable. But like he was wanted to use that discomfort. I mean that you know that's those kind of stories. I think are few and far between. And again, like she was, you know, their friends, and like. Mm-hmm. There's an interview on the DVD where they you know talk about that story together in the same room. And, you know, I think the conversation about, like, how he uses women in his movie and specifically violence against women, that conversation has happened a few times. Like, I remember when Lost Highway came out, that was talked about a lot. And when Twin Peaks The Return came out, that was talked about a lot because there is a lot of sexual violence in that show. Like, especially, right at the beginning of that show. I mean, I ultimately came to love it, but I think right off the bat, I was certainly put off by some of the treatment of the female characters. Not that he's condoning it, but like he certainly utilizes that story a lot. And yeah, and sometimes it's very uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you know, I do love him. I do love being taken to these worlds that he creates always. I would consider myself a devotee. I will watch anything he does. I mean, it's an obvious, you know, filmmaking touchstone to have is to like David Lynch, but I can't help it. I do love David Lynch. A couple of things I do want to say, talking about watching it now as opposed to watching it when I was younger, two big things are seeing the influences more at play. And that being like, I'd seen Vertigo already when I'd seen this, but like, having seen Vertigo more and knowing what a fan of that movie he is, like, and also having seen Sunset Boulevard, that's another one, and having seen Carnival of Souls, which I only watched fairly recently in the last few years and hadn't seen, and that watching Mulholland Drive after having seen Carnival of Souls, there's so much of Carnival of Souls in Mulholland Drive. I mean, yeah, I've heard about that being an influence for him and in other movies like Lost Highway, but like that's a movie that literally opens with a woman in a car accident and a woman who is, you know, spoiler alert for Carnival of Souls, who is dead and is being pursued by these kind of like otherworldly phantom men. Yeah. So I think that's interesting that he's kind of, you know, he is, you know, he's cataloging all of these influences and kind of having them play out. Yeah. And like I said, Vertigo is obviously, this is a mystery where someone gets a haircut and puts on a blonde wig. Yeah. I mean, I love that. And the other thing is, the Twin Peaks of it all. Like I hadn't seen Twin Peaks when I first watched this and watching it now. I mean, going through the stages of having seen this, there also was this theory that this movie takes place in the Twin Peaks universe, not just because the title was almost used for a spinoff, but because, and Blaine, I'm sad that you missed this in your behind the scenes research, but Laura Palmer and Ronette Pulaski from Twin Peaks are in this movie in
what?
Club Silencio.
Oh my God.
You're going to have to watch it again tonight, man. When they first go into that theater and take their seats, there's Laura Palmer, there's Ronette Pulaski, you know, two of the victims from that. So, you know, and then they're sitting in a theater with red curtains, like, you know, the Black Lodge and Twin Peaks. And then when Twin Peaks The Return came out, and then you've got all of these kind of like, again, David Lynch hates poor people because there's all of these like monstrous kind of cartoon hobo type characters.
Those are the same type people.
Yeah, it seems very similar. So I
The ones that make the Gorgonzola.
Yeah, and this is not just like
Garbonza.
This is not just like a, you know, like little Easter egg. Like if you're, you know, calling these actors and having them come out here for this scene, it seems very purposeful. And I do like that. Like all of his movies. One thing I like about his movies is it feels like one's just building on top of the other. Like I remember seeing Inland Empire and thinking like, this is the culmination of all of these themes and things he's been doing. And then like you watch the recent Twin Peaks series and be like, oh no, this is the culmination of all of the things. And you know, now he's doing something for Netflix and maybe I'll have that feeling about that.
Oh,
but
shit.
Yeah, it's rewatchable. But what about you, Blaine?
I get it. I think I get why it's all rewatchable. I will rewatch this movie again, but I'm not.
Damn right you will.
I'm not the biggest David Lynch fan. I just don't go for what he's doing.
Okay, have you seen Eraserhead?
No.
Oh, you've got to watch Eraserhead.
And to be fair, I haven't seen much David Lynch, so I will watch more David Lynch and come back. Maybe we rewatch this movie years from
Have
now.
You seen Inland Empire?
I haven't, no.
Okay, well, hold off on that until you see Eraserhead.
Did you watch Lost Highway? Because Lost Highway was never one of my favorites, but I watched that in the theater recently, too. And I think, you know, I do think that's, you know, honestly, seeing them theatrically, I think, is a big part of it. And which is funny because it was a TV pilot. But even, like, watching the pilot, like, and seeing how those scenes, like, don't play the same on a TV, like, in the 4:3 frame with this kind of, like, artifice of, like, commercial breaks and stuff happening between. There is something about going to a David Lynch movie and sitting down in the dark with strangers and having the, you know, 3 decibels over the normal sound barrier cranked up. You know, there's something about, like, giving yourself over to that world that you can't totally replicate at home. I mean, Inland Empire was a great example. That was one of the greatest theater going experiences I ever had. There's a scene in that movie where Laura Dern shows up at the back of a movie theater and I turned around to look as if she was going to be there like an idiot. And so did everyone else in the theater. Everyone in the theater was looking at the back of the room as if Laura Dern was going to stroll through.
Wow.
So I do think, like, yeah, it's not something you can completely replicate at home or get the full experience at home.
Yeah.
Certainly not on your phone.
I'll watch them all on my on my Apple Watch a little later. But yeah, I mean, I'm not
you have a Game Boy.
So I'm not the best guy to, if I can pixelate it any further. I'm not the best guy to say. But I do see the value of this movie. It doesn't really capture me like I think it captures you guys. And I don't think David Lynch as a filmmaker does yet. But I'm excited to see more of his stuff. As I would of any other filmmaker.
I'll check out more of his stuff. This Lynch guy sounds
young
okay.
Upstart.
He's like,
yeah.
I mean, you should start with his YouTube videos where he talks about the weather and like builds wooden urinals in his shed. That's where you should start.
Is that true? Because I definitely will check that out. That sounds amazing.
Well, he did, you know, he was also, he was a pioneer, like before Patreon and stuff, like he had a pay website where he would upload short films and content specifically for like his patrons. And now he's been doing more on his YouTube channel, including bringing back his weather report, which is him describing the weather as he sees it and experiences it and doing other stuff. Like, he's been building projects and I remember the first one I watched was he built like a little sort of wooden urinal trough in his workspace so he wouldn't have to leave.
You can pee in this if you don't want to go to the bathroom in the house.
And he always ends those videos being like, let me know in the comments what projects you're working on. And it's like, should I let David Lynch know about the IKEA shelf I just put together? No. No, I shouldn't. He's not going to read that.
Maybe you should.
He sounds like a grandfather being like, you know, tell me about your hobbies and we can connect.
He that's is. And nice. He's got like a beard now. I mean, that's the other thing. Like David Lynch is also like a old rich white guy who has been famous since he was very young. And he is in his own world. But that means he's very out of touch from our world. I mean, like, remember he even made that comment, Rob, about like supporting Trump or something? And everyone was like, yeah, he said something that was kind of like pro-Trump at one point, and everyone freaked out. And then he was like, "Oh, never mind. Like, I've heard you're actually not so great," or something. Like, he's great in his own world, and like,
right.
That's great for the movies, yeah. But like.
He's not politically aware.
I even remember, like, he has, like, a new child with a new wife and had to, like, you know, basically say, like, I'm not going to look after this kid. I'm going to work on my shit, and you're going to have to look after the kid in a separate building on this property. Like, he is not going to sacrifice his art for anything, and that's what gives us a lot of great art, but, you know, I mean... I don't know what my point was with this, but I think if you're looking for something beyond the world of David Lynch, you're never going to get it because he is very much about his own kind of cerebral focus at that time. So I can understand why that does put people at a distance, certainly when he comments on politics. But I mean, like, yeah, I hope you do get a chance to see some of them in the theaters and get into it.
Well, I will try. I will try.
We will force you to.
That's what it sounds like.
There will be a car picking you up, and then we will stop at a place.
Force me to get out.
Wasn't expected.
I saw the Fifth Element in the theater.
It's supposed to be watched on a phone, so you really missed the experience there. But I'm glad I rewatched this. Thank you very much for joining us this week on Rewatchability. You can check out all our other podcasts on. Line at rewatchability.com. You can talk to us through, you know, Facebook or Twitter. Twitter's probably best.
Or in your dreams.
Or through the dream logic. You can do that too. And if you really want to support us, you can tell a friend about us. You can tell a coworker about us. You can talk to someone about us. That'd be really great. And if you are a very private person or don't want to interrupt your company's Zoom calls with talk of rewatchability and you still want to support us, you can go to patreon.com/rewatchability and give some change to us there. That'd be really great. And until next time, I have nothing more to say. That's it.
Silencio.
Silencio. Oh, Justin Theroux's hair.
Oh God, yes.
it was because he came, he did a red eye flight to get the audition, and then he showed up in like a frumpy suit that was not ironed with his hair all fucked up from his headphones on the flight. And David Lynch was like, "You're perfect. Keep it."
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.